Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Tehran Conference, which was held at the end of November, early December 1943, just as the outcome of the war is really starting to emerge. The future of Europe and Asia is starting to be really apparent to most of the world. It was held, obviously, in Tehran, the capital of Iran, at the Soviet embassy, and it is the first meeting where all the leaders of the big three, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin, are there at the same time. It was unfortunately sunk the following year. Roosevelt and Churchill at that point had discussed the Atlantic Charter, which is really kind of the basis of the post-war United Nations. And the point of the Atlantic Charter discussions was to have a kind of an ideological, a political, in essence, framework for the prosecution of the war, to be able to say, here is what we are standing for as well as what we are standing against. Churchill had conducted shuttle diplomacy with Stalin in Moscow, despite the fact that Stalin, this is in late 1941, Stalin was facing the most desperate of circumstances. He was still able to kind of belittle Churchill, as was his style, and suggest that, you know, the British fighting men were incapable of a victory, or they were afraid of the Germans, something that really Churchill took a particular exception to. Supposedly the apocryphal tale is that the two men saw eye to eye over a long boozy evening in Stalin's apartment. The British and the Soviets had divided and partitioned Iran in 1941. There was the suspicion that Iran might possibly become a pro-Axis state, and the division of the country helped to create a southern pipeline to the Soviet Union, and also it helped the British and the Soviets to control Iranian oil, something that would have interesting post-war repercussions for Iran and for the West. Stalin was very paranoid about flying. He was very reluctant to go further afield, and he eventually agrees to Tehran because it falls within a Soviet sphere of influence. And while he's there, on the subject of spheres of influence, his first demands are that the Soviets be given free rein in Eastern Europe at the end of the war, and also that the British and the Americans help to support Tito and the communist partisans who were fighting a guerrilla war against German occupation. This is interesting because, as we'll explore hopefully in later podcasts, this is a topic I really want to get to in the near future. Stalin and Tito have a an almighty falling out after the war, as Stalin becomes very suspicious of communist states that establish themselves without Red Army help and without the overall guidance of Moscow. What he definitely doesn't want is a third way emerging, an independent socialist voice in the world. Far rather Hitler than Tito, he said. One of Stalin's issues with diplomacy and with conferences that came to light shortly before the Tehran conference, much like his dislike, his eventual dislike of Tito, was his refusal to have any meetings with Chiang Kai-shek, the Chinese nationalist leader. Chiang was had been actually received direct support from Stalin throughout the 1930s and had been Stalin's favoured candidate for rulership of China. Stalin particularly wasn't very keen on Mao emerging. But as the war continued, Chiang Kai-shek's territorial claims and the post-war picture of a strong China that he wanted to create that would not brook much Soviet interference meant that the two men came to be suspicious and distrustful of one another, and Stalin refused to meet Chiang at the Cairo conference that had happened a couple of weeks beforehand. And the next major issue to emerge was that of a second front in Europe. Franklin Roosevelt had rather rashly promised Stalin in 1942 a second front, and Stalin was anxious to know when this was going to transpire. The British at the Casablanca conference, if you scroll back a few podcasts, there is a whole thing on the Casablanca conference in early 1943, had suggested that a second front, by which we mean really an amphibious invasion of France a la D-Day, would be impossible that year. And Stalin felt that the continued promises of second fronts, as he saw it, and the continued denial of a second front, meant that the West was doing this probably on purpose, to drag out the war in the East as long as possible and to see both sides, Nazism and Communism, destroy each other. And he became insistent that, and gave veiled threats, that unless some kind of second front emerged, then he might have to make his own peace with Hitler. The answer that the, as we see throughout the events of 1943, and again in the Casablanca conference podcast, you can catch this, that Churchill believed that a second front was already in existence in Italy. The Allies had invaded Italy in 1943, and the amount of damage and troops tied up by the Allied bombing campaign over Germany, which intensified enormously with the combined bombing offensive of 1943, meant that the RAF and the US Army Air Force were both bringing a kind of second front from the air to Germany. Churchill was quite happy to pursue a Mediterranean strategy because it helped the British to control a stretch of water and territory that was very important to them. It helped them to hang on to the Suez Canal, it helped to have free access to India. The British had bases in Palestine, in Egypt, in Cyprus, in Malta, in Gibraltar. And the with the decline of Italy and the elimination of Italy by 1943, I beg your pardon, when Italy surrenders and Mussolini is ejected from power, it meant that Britain could view herself as the dominant power in the Mediterranean, of course propped up with American help. Things like the Battle of El Alamein were not won without enormous quantities of American tanks and artillery. And Churchill was anxious to pursue a Mediterranean strategy that had been successful at Casablanca, all the way through to Tehran. And it's at Tehran, really, that Roosevelt pulls rank and says that he believes Operation Overlord, or D-Day, should be the next major operation of the Western Allies. There have been so many errors and mistakes and failings in the Italian campaign, things such as Anzio, that really the performance of British and Commonwealth forces, and to some extent American as well, within the Mediterranean, had been fairly average. So there was an awful lot of pressure for the cross-channel invasion to happen as soon as possible. The Soviets want it and the Americans want it, and Churchill is in a very, very difficult bargaining position. A date of May 1944 is agreed, and Stalin agrees to coordinate a simultaneous attack, one that eventually emerges as Operation Bagration in the east. Because of Churchill's insistence on the Mediterranean strategy, and because Stalin had recently had an enormous victory at the Battle of Kursk, which was the greatest tank battle in history, where the Germans were decidedly defeated, Stalin has a huge number of cards to play. Not only can he see and has successfully spied on the British and Americans, and knows that they are divided and bickering amongst each other, but also him being able to present the Russians as successful warriors, as providing the Grand Alliance with profound victories, makes it very difficult for people like Roosevelt to not give Stalin what he wants. Stalin's lifelong suspicion of the Poles and his lifelong desire, really, dating back since 1920, to really dominate Poland, and his suspicion that Poland could be used as a means to subvert Soviet security after the war, led to him demanding successfully the right to retain all territories invaded under the Nazi-Soviet Pact of 1939. Churchill thought that by way of compensating the Poles, because of course the British had gone to war to secure Polish freedom, and the discussion of handing the Poles from one dictator to another was deeply rancorous to Churchill, and he felt it was very difficult to make the case that the war had had any meaning at all to the British people if we did that. Churchill decided to insist that the Poles be compensated at the Germans' expense, so a slice of eastern Germany would be given to western Poland. All this is done without a Polish delegation present, much as the Munich Conference, the outcome of the Munich Conference, was presented to the Czechs in 1938. And the Poles have no idea for about a year that these kinds of decisions are being made. There's one very interesting revealing moment at dinner that evening, where Roosevelt, Stalin and Churchill discussed what to do in terms of punishing Germany. And these are the first conversations, really, about the possible post-war retribution and justice. And Stalin has a brutally simple solution. He says, let's just take 50 to 100,000 of the top men of the regime, from Hitler downwards all the way through to Nazi Party members, generals, officers, and execute them. Churchill says this would be an unconscionable act, and storms from the dinner table. In some ways, it might be interpreted as one of the kind of Stalin's games and Stalin's attempts to undermine Churchill, to wind him up, for want of a better word, But in other ways, it's entirely possible that this is what Stalin thought would be an acceptable measure. Not only would it satisfy Stalin's thirst for retribution, but also it would really decapitate German leadership. And this is, in essence, what the Soviets had done in Poland with a purge of the intelligentsia and the clergy. They had, they believed what they were doing were killing off the Poles' ability to be led in some meaningful way. So it is entirely possible that that was a serious suggestion. In the outcome of the conference, the communist partisans in Yugoslavia suddenly received a boost in Allied aid. Originally, the anti-fascist partisans, the Chetniks, the nationalists, were supported by the British and Americans, though there had been a strong suspicion for some time that they were not particularly anti-fascist at all and were actually quite pro-Nazi, and in many instances were cooperating with them along the kind of lines of the ethnic civil war within Yugoslavia that was also raging at the same time. The cross-channel invasions decided for May 1944, though ultimately it happens a month later. And there is also talk of trying to draw Turkey into the war on the Allied side, though nothing eventually comes of this. Turkey declared war on Germany in February 1945, along with a number of other world powers that wanted to be part of the kind of the post-war order without really having done the fighting to create it. One thing that's clear about the Tehran Conference is that there had been a diminution in Britain's role as an Allied decision maker. Britain had been seen in 1942, when the Americans first joined the British in actions, as perhaps the senior partner in the relationship. America had a great deal of equipment and money, but perhaps they deferred to the British, assuming they had more fighting experience. But various British disasters along the way, things such as Tobruk or the fall of Singapore, left the Americans less certain that the British were really capable of being the wiser elder figure in the relationship. And certainly American manpower, material and just military might, along with that of the Soviet Union, leaves the British by the end of Tehran less diplomatically in charge, slightly more diplomatically isolated, and certainly not able to argue for a Mediterranean strategy any longer. And that is something that has profound implications for the post-war world. The post-war world was not one that where the British Empire was going to be able to continue to be a world force for very much longer. And certainly by the end of the 1950s and the early 1960s, this is definitely the case, and it's in rapid decline. So anyway, hope you found that interesting. In the next week or so, we should have Julia Routledge's The Genocidal Century published on Explaining History. And by Christmas, Gina Bolter's new After Mao, China from 1976 to the 1990s will be ready as well. I'll keep you posted on those. Thanks very much, and catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.